Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey everybody, welcome back to a very special episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is not Steven DeGennaro, and I am not joined by Scott Weinberg. Say hi, not Scott.
Hi, not Steven.
We are here for a very special episode, which I've repeated now because it's doubly true. Steven, why don't you break down the films we're about to discuss?
So we are going to be discussing what is arguably the most famous science fiction movie of all time. Certainly the most successful science fiction movie series of all time. A little independent feature from an unknown director named, Lucas George.
It's the Star Wars.
The Star Wars.
1977's Star Wars. An absolutely wonderful sci-fi classic that everybody knows and loves to some degree or another.
But Scott, is it really science fiction?
We're going to get into that. And what film are we pairing it up with? A film I adore, 1980's Flash Gordon, which I love wholeheartedly and unironically. So before we even get into the quality of Star Wars, let us delve into this giant question, this wonderful debate that has, and I see both sides of it. I plant my vote on one side, but I see both sides of the argument. And the argument is, Star Wars and its ilk are not science fiction because they are pure space fantasy. They don't have any talons rooted in real science, like even something like Armageddon does, you know.
Well, that's debatable, too.
But what in Star Wars is based in our real science? There are answers. But I think Steven and I are in agreement on both. It is science fiction. It absolutely is.
Of course it's science fiction.
Even if you just wanted to break it down to the most pedantic reason, it's got robots and spaceships. That alone has its talons planted in real science.
Yes.
All right. But Steven, now, what's your take on this argument?
Oh, I mean, I think it's a kind of a ridiculous argument. Of course it's science fiction.
But why has that argument, or not even argument, but like debate, why has that blossomed for so many years?
Because Star Wars superfans can be some of the most pedantic people in the world.
No.
When they want to be.
Oh, maybe.
Like the really hardcore ones? Yeah, kind of.
Maybe. But I could see the argument that I made earlier that it's not, you know, rooted in an immediate science that we know and recognize. But space equals science in a way. You know, space exploration, even if it's extrapolated to the distant future or the distant past, outer space kind of indicates an innate scientific approach. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Okay.
Why not? Yes, it's space. It's things traveling faster than light. It is. I mean, it's a silly argument.
All right. But I did want to address it, and let's move on. We have dismissed the argument. It is now settled for all time, and Star Wars is science fiction. Done. Now, Steven, this is going to be difficult because it is nearly impossible to separate Star Wars from what it spawned, meaning at wonderful sequels, not some not-so-great sequels, some in-the-middle sequels, a lot of animation, comic books, toys.
Some terrible prequels.
Terrible prequels. Yeah, you name it. It spawned everything. Is it possible to just watch Star Wars as a two-hour film?
Of course. Lots of people did.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean today, obviously. Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows? Who cares? It doesn't matter. It is.
Well,
it is.
I can say, I'll answer my own question and say, absolutely, it can be. Star Wars, or to the younger people who might know it, Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. It is my favorite Star Wars movie. I think Empire is better in several ways, but I just love a movie that is its own complete beast. If Star Wars had flopped and it had been just one isolated little special movie, I would still just love it for being its own three acts, its own. It has an ending. It leaves you wanting more, but it is its own piece. And that makes it like kind of a sliver, like an eyelash more of my favorite. And I think what makes it so much fun to revisit over and over is not just the mythology that it spawned, but the characters. Without those characters, it's just a bunch of empty noise. If you don't like Leia and Luke and Han and Ben Kenobi and the droids, and you're not into their journey, as wild and crazy as it gets sometimes, then you have junk. It's just junk without the human element.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I would disagree with that. I think that there are a lot of – there were certainly a lot of critics when the movie first came out that could appreciate a lot of what works about the movie while not connecting with the characters or feeling that the characters were not well drawn or thin or whatever. I don't agree with those criticisms, but there is certainly – the movie has a lot to offer just beyond – I mean, just in terms of visual spectacle, in terms of interesting ideas, in terms of mythic – storytelling. I think that, you know, all of those things are true about this movie.
Fair enough.
And they all work together with the great characters who, let's not forget, right? So, you know, people of our generation, you're a couple years older than me. I saw Jedi in the theater. I obviously did not see Star Wars in the theater because it came out the year that I was born. I do not recall the first time that I saw Star Wars. It's literally just a movie that has, we had it on VHS taped off of HBO, and I watched it 1,000 times before I was 10 years old.
It's like a memory of your parents.
Right.
It's like, it's always been there. Right.
Right. But my views of this movie are, of course, colored by what comes after, especially of the, you know, for a long time that was just the original trilogy. But the characters are deepened a lot in the sequels.
But is that fair? Is that fair to let a movie be colored by what comes after?
Well, so what I'm saying is that I think that the characters are deepened considerably in, especially in the second movie, and then also definitely in the third movie. And Luke Skywalker undergoes an entire arc. You know, undergoes an arc over the course of this movie, but he really undergoes a much bigger and more profound arc over the course of the original trilogy. And I think that if you are the kind of person who grew up with these movies always basically existing, then it's impossible to just look at the first movie and not see all of the places where those characters are going to go in the back of your brain.
I suppose, but I really, as hard as I can, I try to just watch the individual movie for what it is. And yeah, it's impossible to, you know, forget everything that comes after Star Wars. But as hard as I might, watched it again a few weeks ago, it just holds up as, like, if you can put aside the giant pop culture juggernaut, if you can put aside all that luggage, the great luggage, the mediocre luggage, and the awful, if you can put everything aside, just except for the 2 hours and 7 minutes, I think it is, it's just a great adventure movie. It is everything that Lucas wanted, and it is not just great entertainment. It signifies or typifies my favorite thing about filmmaking, in that it's really, really hard to come up with an original, fresh idea. Anybody who does, I'm impressed by, even if it's something like The Purge. I remember being like, wow, I wish I had thought of that premise. What a cool premise, you know?
Yeah.
Simple as that.
It Follows was another one.
Oh, yeah, It Follows. Great hook. And so if the next best thing to being completely original is taking disparate elements that you love, like The Hidden Fortress and World War II films and Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, and then you combine all those things that you adore into something that may not be startlingly original on its own, but is impactful, is just a watershed at Star Wars. You know, I mean, like, there's DNA from 5 or 6 different films in Star Wars. Lucas has admitted it from day one.
Yeah. Well, so I want to. Yeah. Ironically, one of those strands of DNA is the old Flash Gordon serials. And I want to save this discussion until we get to Flash Gordon. But I think this movie, I think there's a very big difference between what this movie does with its influences and what Flash Gordon does with its influences that illustrates for me a lot about the current crop of nostalgia that has crept into recent movies. But I want to save that until we start talking about Flash Gordon. So
okay, fair enough. And as most of our listeners will probably know, Lucas did want to adapt Flash Gordon. That was his plan. He could not acquire the rights. I don't know if De Laurentiis had them at that point or if they were just held by the original rights owners. But because he couldn't get the rights to Flash Gordon, he did what I said 5 minutes ago and just built his own beautiful Star Wars, and inspired, obviously, by Flash Gordon. And then the massive success of Star Wars led to Dano De Laurentiis acquiring the rights to Flash Gordon and producing it in 1980, inspired directly by the success of the film that had to get made because Lucas... So, like, what's the old phrase? Like, necessity is the...
Mother of invention.
Yes, thank you. Necessity is the mother of invention. And it's like, oh, how disappointed he must have been that he couldn't get the rights to Flash Gordon. He must have been devastated. And then the next day, the light bulb goes on and goes, fine, I'll just combine 5 or 6 things that I love into something unique.
Yeah.
And that's what he did.
And then execute the hell out of it.
Yeah, execute the hell out of it and believe in it.
Yeah.
Like, that's something that a lot of people overlook. It's hard to direct a movie. It's hard to direct something like this. It's infinitely harder to be the one of maybe five or six people who constantly believe in it all the way through.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lucas has done some things in his career that I don't love, like the special editions. But you'll never hear me shit talk the guy because I'm just so impressed by, you know, even if you were to just focus on the original trilogy and nothing else, the man is a master filmmaker. He just is.
Well, I think he's far better when he surrounds himself with and trusts good collaborators.
Agreed. He had to hire directors for Empire and Return because he was not in the Directors Guild anymore. You can read up on that. But he had to hire directors who would, you know, kind of be a director, but also kind of be willing to let him come in and ghost direct it at every opportunity. And he got Irvin Kershner for Empire.
And let's be honest, Empire would not be what it is without Kersh's stamp on it.
Oh, yeah.
At all.
Yeah, it has a real gravity to it, and as much as I love Star Wars,
and a humanity to it.
Yes, it's like a gravitas, I should say. It starts to really feel Shakespearean and epic in this movie, in Empire, when you're like, I care about these characters and their next journey and their next destination. That Empire does all that, and I think Irvin Kershner.
But it's also filled with all these amazing little character moments that I don't think Lucas would have ever put in.
But that goes back to give him credit for not only did he have to hire directors, but he hired good directors. Richard Marquand directed Return. So back to Star Wars.
Yes.
I saw it in its original theatrical run. I was very little. My sister, if you were to ask her, will tell you the anecdote about how I was enraptured for the first 25 minutes, and then I bounced all over the place, wouldn't shut up, kept turning around in my chair. I was being annoying, obnoxious. And then when the movie ended, all I talked about for weeks was how much I loved it. And she kept telling people all he saw was the first 20 minutes. And I told her, stop telling people that. But now that I'm a grown man and that's all in the distant past, I can admit she was right. I only watched the first 20 minutes and the rest I was just...
Well, that's ironic because the VHS copy that we had taped off of HBO, sort of typical of a lot of our things that we taped off of HBO in those days, was missing the first 3 to 5 minutes because, you know, by the time we realized it was on and got the tape in and started recording it, my parents presumably, or maybe my older brother, they were already mid-battle with, it was like right before Darth Vader blows the hatch open and comes into.
Oh, good Lord.
So I never saw the opening crawl. I never saw that iconic opening shot of, of the thing.
Wow.
Like for literally, I don't think I ever saw that until I saw it in the theater when they released the special editions when I was in college.
I don't think younger people really grasp the whole idea of if Star Wars happened to be on HBO and you put a tape in, now you own a copy of Star Wars. But on the other hand, to be fair to young people, what we didn't realize back in the day is, yeah, we now had a copy of Star Wars that was stretched out, bleached, pixelated, and just ugly as hell. We didn't realize until we were older that that's not what Star Wars is supposed to look like.
Well, look, watching this on my brand new 4K HDR TV on Disney Plus was a revelation. It was, yeah. I mean, like you can see the pores in people's faces. You can see dings and scratches on Darth Vader's helmet or C-3PO's armor, whatever you call it.
Let me ask you this. Off the top of your head, could you name like two or three moments that were added for the special edition? Could you guess?
I feel like the more... let's just not talk about that. I think in this movie in particular, I think there are a couple of moments in Empire that are kind of cool. In this movie, other than sort of cleaning up some of the effects a little bit, I don't think any of the additions of the special edition make the movie better in any way at all.
I agree. I don't want to focus on the original versus special editions, but it is worth mentioning. There's some stuff in the special edition that I just literally cringe at because I've seen the original version like a lot of people, 10, 12, 14 times. And I know that desert isn't supposed to have a little monster in the bottom right. And I can't train my brain to ignore that stuff. And therefore, that new stuff annoys me. On the other hand, you're right. It does make just the effects and the sound mix and everything else is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Not being able to see like the black boxes around the spaceships as they fly through space from the optical compositing. Like that alone.
Oh, yeah.
That's worth the price of admission. But... man, I did not need CGI Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, that bugs me. And, you know, it always was a fascinating deleted scene that we were like, whoa, this would have been so cool. And you saw the original actor and Han. There's more of Han. So, of course, that's so cool. We wish that was in the movie. Oh, my God. And then you watch it and you're like, nah, you don't need it. There's nothing right. in this scene we don't already know. It was cut for a good reason.
Exactly. Like, leaving aside the bad CGI, there's literally nothing in that. That conversation is almost like a beat-for-beat copy of the same exact conversation he just had with Greedo like 2 minutes ago. It's completely not necessary.
Minor nitpicks, including the special edition nitpicks aside, it is magic.
But whatever. I don't think we need to really talk all that much about Star Wars or analyzing it or any of that. You know, there's none of that stuff that hasn't been done to death, and it's not what you came here for. So I'd say let's move on to the science.
Okay, I got lots of science. For a movie that is allegedly not science fiction, it's got lots of interesting science questions in it.
It does.
I'm going to throw this one out off the top of my head. Steven, in theory, would a tractor beam actually work?
I mean, there are tractor beams that work on a microscopic level. It's hard. You don't ever really know what the technology is that does that. The ship is a giant thing made out of metal. So as you are probably aware, metal, at least certain kinds of metal, are magnetic. And so it's possible to imagine a magnet that was, you know, powerful enough and somehow or another channeled in some way that we don't understand.
Focused enough.
Right, which is not a thing that I think we know how to do with our current technology, but it's not, I guess, theoretically impossible. So, I don't know. If you had a big enough magnet, yeah, you could attract anything made out of metal.
This speaks to what we talked about before. When you're a good writer and a good director, you jam it right into there. It's a tractor beam. It's a beam, and it's pulling them toward the ship. You didn't know what a tractor beam was 5 seconds ago. Now you do. It's really simple, clever, you know.
Well, that's an old, old concept in science fiction. The term tractor beam was coined by E.E. Smith in a novel in 1931.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was a shortening of a tractor beam, as in it attracts things. And he decided to call it a tractor
beam. Oh, my God. All these years, I thought it was like tractor, like a farm vehicle. Tractor beam.
Nope. I mean, it functions that way as well. But no, the etymology of it comes from a novel from the 1930s.
Neat. That is really cool. Very cool. All right, I had a very fun question on Twitter. Somebody said, how does the lightsaber know when to stop forming?
Well,
like when you turn it on, it grows to like 7 feet, right? And then right. it stops.
Well, it is called a lightsaber, and that, you know, implies, I guess, that it's made out of light. But there are lots of things that we call things in our current world that aren't actually, for instance, calling something a tractor beam has no actual technical relation to a tractor. It is a tractor beam. So, like, it's entirely possible that they're called lightsabers because they look like they're made out of light, but the thing that they're actually made out of is not actually light. Now, there are probably some Star Wars people that are going to, like, you know, jump in our Twitter feed with canon whatnot, but, like...
Oh, yeah. We'll put in a disclaimer right now. Steven and I are well aware that we are serious Star Wars fans, but we are not experts on the minutiae. We are not. So if you know information about this that is interesting and not just you want to wag your fingers, let us know on Twitter and we will mention it in an upcoming episode if it's interesting.
Yeah. And let's be honest, right? Most of that stuff comes from material, obviously, that's not part of the movies, and in large part is often not part of the shows or any of the actual entertainment part. It's supplementary stuff.
At best.
It's basically written by guys like us, right, who are like, all right, well, let me think of a way that could actually make some sense. And then it comes out in the Star Wars, you know, book of technology or whatever, the coffee table book, and that, because it's officially sort of canon, becomes the official explanation. But most of the time, that was just written by some guy, essentially, right? It's certainly not authored by George Lucas or not.
Okay, you know. So what we're saying is the blade of the lightsaber, aka laser sword, is not actually light. It is a laser, because if it was just light, it would pass right through you and would not zap you or burn you. It would just light you up like a flashlight.
Well, no. Oh, on the contrary, you could absolutely, like, murder somebody very quickly and easily with a powerful enough laser.
No, I said light, though. Laser and light are not the same thing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so the term laser is an acronym.
Right, it means self-contained underwater breathing apparatus.
That is correct.
All right, God, I'm sorry. Laser means?
No, laser means light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And so—
Okay, got it. So it's radiated light.
It's light. It's a laser is light.
It's irradiated light.
That's what light is.
What makes the laser dangerous is not the light.
Yes.
It's the radiation.
No. Radiation is another word for light. Electromagnetic radiation is what light is. It is electromagnetic radiation. So
look, I have a PhD in astrophysics. You went to like Sundance for 6 years. Big deal. What? Oh wait, I got the other way around. All right, so go ahead. I want to do more about lightsabers. Give me your scientific analysis of how a lightsaber works in theory.
I don't know. I wouldn't even purport to try to figure that out. Some sort of plasma something, yada, yada, yada. Who knows? It's a laser sword. It's not scientific in any way. What's more interesting to me is the blasters, which are never actually, certainly not in the original trilogy and not, as far as I know, in canon at all. They're always called blasters. They're presumed to be lasers because lasers and ray beams and whatever else were things that were prevalent in science fiction of the era that Lucas is.
Yeah, but you saw the special edition, man. Those lasers, they shoot like little lightsaber bolts.
They're not lasers. They're bolts. They are blaster bolts. They're not lasers. That's the whole point. So number one, first of all, you wouldn't be able to see a laser from the side unless there was a lot of smoke or something else, right? If you shine a laser pointer at the wall in an empty room, you don't see the laser from the side. It has to reflect off of something in order to be able to see it from the side. But more to the point, if you actually measure the speed at which those bolts travel, you can figure out roughly how fast blaster bolts travel in the Star Wars universe. And the answer turns out to be something on the order of about 80 or so miles an hour, which you may recognize as slower than pretty much any Major League Baseball pitcher can pitch. Meaning, like, if you can hit a baseball, then you can dodge a laser blaster.
Your point is that what comes out of a blaster is slower than generally a thrown baseball.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so, okay. Not terribly dangerous in that regard, and certainly not as fast as, certainly nowhere near, obviously, as fast as light, which makes it definitely not a laser, but also considerably slower than, like, a bullet, which travels at, you know, thousands of miles per hour.
Here's my question about blasters. Does anybody in Star Wars ever in any way reload a blaster?
No, but I don't know that you would necessarily have to. They're clearly some sort of particle weapon, right? They're shooting a beam of something. That beam is almost certainly not light. It could be a beam of electrons or alpha particles or, you know, some sort of exotic particle.
But it's not a physical ammunition. It's
no, nothing. It might very well be. That's my point. But
then you'd have to reload the thing with the physics alone.
Not necessarily, because if you're talking about subatomic particles, you can fit a whole heck of a lot of those into a very small space. And so,
fair enough. Design a blaster. Go ahead. I won't stop
you. I don't
know.
It may very well be. Who knows? I think it's meant to be some sort of particle beam of some sort or another. The major thing, and again, this is not really even a physics thing as much as it is a logic thing. If those blaster bolts were traveling at you at about 80 miles an hour, blocking one with a lightsaber would be roughly the equivalent of hitting a pitch from a not particularly good pro
right.
baseball pitcher.
From a decent college player, yeah. Or a decent retiring player, I should
decent
say.
Decent high school probably could throw 80 miles an hour.
No, because high school, they got strong arm. I mean, a guy at the end of his career who can barely get it up to 82 miles an hour. It's interesting. I never really thought the velocity of the ammunition in the weapons. How do you figure out that number?
Well, you find a blaster bolt, you know, in the movie, and you freeze frame it, and you see how far it goes and how long it takes to get there, and you estimate what the distance is, and you know exactly how long it takes because you can count the number of frames it took to get there.
Interesting.
And then you divide and you do that enough times. One of the interesting things is that the angular speed across the screen is roughly constant, whether it's a space blaster bolt. So like, you know, at the beginning of the movie, there's the Star Destroyer is shooting the blockade runner. Those bolts travel across the screen at roughly the same speed as handheld blaster bolts. But of course, the distances involved are considerably bigger, right?
Yeah. So okay, interesting.
In world, they travel a lot faster than hand blaster bolts.
So in theory, what you're saying is if we were to cut inside, the blasters looked like normal blasters that we're used to. If we were to cut outside, the Star Destroyer's ammunition would look relatively slow.
If it were those blaster bolts were the same kind of blaster bolts. But there's no reason to believe that they would be. Obviously, you would imagine a ship would have more powerful weapons than a hand blaster. So.
Good Lord. All right, we're getting too deep into the minutia there. How about robots? Let's talk robots.
Okay.
That's it.
Is there a question?
All right. On one hand, R2-D2 seems to be like the most convenient, functional, useful robot in the world. They imply that he needs to be, he can be plugged into a vehicle to help help power it, whether it's a land speeder or an X-Wing fighter.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's pretty functional. It's like, he's like a walking battery and he can do other things.
Now, well, he can hack into pretty much any computer.
Yeah, yeah. But C-3PO seems to be wildly impractical. He's built so that he can barely walk, and his only real job is protocol and translating.
Right. Well, that's
You could do that with a, something the size of a phone.
You could, but would it have a personality?
Why couldn't R2-D2 do that?
Well, so I think that, you know, I think that there are definitely advantages to making a protocol droid humanoid. I think that the entire point of a protocol droid is to, you know, like for instance in the opening scene of Phantom Menace, you see a protocol droid actually functioning as a protocol droid, welcoming the Jedi onto the ship. Having somebody that can, like, bring you tea and act like a butler.
Yeah, he's a butler.
Exactly.
He's a robotic butler.
Well, a robotic butler is a lot cheaper to maintain than a human butler. I think that's the whole point.
All right. I'm just thinking if his job is 80% translating and giving facts and figures, you could put that in a phone and stick it to R2-D2's head. Anyway.
But again, that was not his original function. He functions this way in this movie because he's kind of been bounced around and he's not in his... in his element, right? He is a protocol droid. His job is to be, you know, presumably the, you know, rich people have, you know, armies of C-3POs that greet their guests and whatever else. Like, he's a rich person's droid.
That sounds horrible. That sounds like a horrible world.
Well, so this does bring up, you know, one of the things that is highlighted more as the series goes on, especially in Solo, is the status of droids as, you know, are they... alive. I mean, they're not alive, obviously, in the biological sense, but they appear to have personalities and consciousnesses.
Right. No, it's the great Blade Runner question. If a robot is aware that they exist, does it make it cruel to mistreat them? Simple as that.
Well, and yeah, is it murder if you erase their memory?
Right.
You know
what used to put me in awe as a kid? The design of the Sandcrawler. It's epic. It's giant.
And we had the toy.
Huh?
We had the toy.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't have that. I had virtually everything, but I didn't have the Falcon, and I didn't have the but I did have the Death Star. And you know what the Death Star had? It had the trash compactor monster, and the trash inside was little foam pieces, like someone cut up a sponge.
Yeah. We had the monster.
I didn't know it until later, but the name of the monster is technically the Dianoga.
Yep.
And if you want to read a brilliant, brilliantly funny article, Google McSweeney's. That's the website, and Trash Compactor. I forget the name of the article. I've read it probably 3 times over the years, and it's about the impracticality of having a trash compactor in a space station.
Yeah.
It just, like, when do they vent it? Where does it go? How does the creature survive when they vent it?
Why is all that water in the bottom of it?
Why is there water? Yeah. It's a wonderfully funny article. You have anything on the trash compactor?
Well, I mean, it's a silly sort of thing.
It's a great cliffhanger moment. I love it. Not cliffhanger, but great, like, you know, oh, you could see that in a 1930s movie with Tarzan, and he's like, you know, in a hidden temple, and the walls are trapping them, and they're screaming. And yep. But yeah,
that's a great moment. But
as a kid, I wondered if the walls close, doesn't that kill the monster?
Well, no, presumably the monster goes away. Like, it has some sort of, like, the monster, you know, feeds on trash, and that's how they know that the walls are about to close in, right? The monster lets Luke go because it hears, you know, the walls clicking.
Oh, yeah,
or whatever,
yeah, good point.
And goes,
you're right.
All right,
you're
I better get out of here because it's going to be bad news if I stay.
I also do want to throw in one other plug. There's a book. I did a search for The Science of Star Wars because I thought it was a book, and it is. It's by a former NASA astrophysicist named Jean Cavelos. And it looks like a pretty fun book. And the 5 topics that she covers in this book are planetary environments. Steven, anything on planetary environments? It's one of my favorite things about Star Wars is that each planet is pretty much its own climate. And that's it.
Well, that's a little ridiculous, right? There's an ice world. Well, so you can imagine, like, for instance, a desert planet, right? A desert planet. I imagine in a desert planet there are places in fairly high latitudes that are habitable. But if you, you know, actually went down to the, you know, the equator, it would probably, it might even be too hot. I mean, we have a desert planet right here in our own solar system. Mars is essentially Tatooine, right, with an atmosphere. You could buy that there's an ice planet, right? Because again, we have one of those right here. We have several of those right here in our solar system. Several of the moons of the gas giants, and of course, Pluto and Charon. You know, but when they start talking about planets as being only jungle, or my particular favorite, Coruscant, which is a planet that is all city, a planet that was all city would have a completely unbreathable atmosphere.
How about all water?
Right, or an all water, you could all, yeah, an all water world, I could absolutely. In fact, it's kind of a weird fluke in some ways that we have land at all. There's not really any reason why the Earth, but again, the fact that every single planet in this entire place.
What about Endor? We're jumping ahead two movies, but what about a giant tree planet?
The forest moon of Endor. Well, it's a moon. Endor is a moon.
Oh, right.
Well, it is the forest moon of Endor. Endor is the planet. The moon is where they go, where the forest is. Again, I don't, you know, it's hard to imagine you could have an entire planet that was covered with forest, because it's hard to imagine that there wouldn't be places that were colder than other places that were warmer. And so, but.
Right. And even though the Star Wars universe likes to imply that this is the fire planet, this is the granite planet, you know, we don't know that for sure. The other side of the planet could be just the opposite. We don't know.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, that's one of the things that Star Wars and Lucas, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but the one climate planet is a direct take from Flash Gordon, as we'll see soon. All right, so chapter 1, planetary environments. Chapter 2, aliens. 3, droids. 4, spaceships and weapons. And 5, the Force.
Yeah, I mean,
she whatever. Discusses the the plausibility of Jedi powers and the Force by exploring quantum physical concepts of tachyons and superstring theory, as well as various fringe and parascientific concept of parapsychology.
So the Force, you know, as far as this movie is concerned, the Force is a mystical power, right? It is explicitly mystical. They try to sort of demystify it a little bit in some of the later movies, and particularly the prequel, where they have the midichlorians, which are an actual physical thing that is measurable in the cells of a person.
Hey, and in the grand history of Lucas's good and bad ideas, I would put midichlorians right up there with the special editions.
Oh, I mean, it's clearly one of the worst ideas, yes, in the entire canon.
And it's just my opinion, obviously. I'm not the word of Star Wars lore here, but in my opinion, the Force used to be, could be faith, could be love, could be God, could be religion, could be friendship, could be hope. It could be anything you wanted it to be. And now it's literally blood cells.
Well, a friend of mine once pointed out an unintended consequence of that, which is if these things are genuinely like real, and he has this little meter that can measure people's midichlorians, and this is not, you know, the prequels are not that long before the original trilogy. It's only about 20 years. That kind of makes Han like an anti-science nut job when he calls it ancient weapons and hokey religion. That he's basically a science denier. He's the equivalent of an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, he'd be like a flat earther in a way.
Right.
Han Solo, if you take the Force as midichlorians as true, that makes Han Solo a flat earther.
Basically, yeah.
That's terrible. But not to get too much into the prequels, but a good way to dismiss all of that is that the midichlorians were just Qui-Gon's own pet theory, and very few other Jedi actually agreed with him, and they rolled their eyes when he left the room, and it, you know, like, that's how I look at it.
That he was the nut job.
Yeah, that Qui-Gon was the one who believed in midichlorians, and the rest of the Jedi Council was like, ugh, this guy with his stupid theory.
It's like a 9/11 truther, this guy.
It's like saying goodness is in your DNA. Come on, you're not born good or bad.
Man, I feel like we could do a 5-hour episode on this thing alone, because here are some of the things that I have in my notes that we haven't even touched on. Hyperspace and light speed.
I have that in mind as well. Let's do it.
So they call it light speed in the movie, but it's clearly not actually light speed, because the speed of light is finite. And if they were traveling actually at the speed of light, so just for a point of comparison, if their galaxy was anything like ours, the average distance between stars, especially on the, quote, outer rim, where Tatooine is probably on the order of 5 to 10 light years. Meaning even if you were traveling at the speed of light, it would still take you 5 or 10 years to get to the closest possible star. To travel all the way across the galaxy at the speed of light would take you approximately 50,000 years. So clearly they're not actually going the speed of light, because they get to places much faster than 50,000 years.
Jumping to light speed is the implication that we're going past But then, what is hyperspace?
Well, they also call it hyperspace, and they are clearly related to one another. So there's this idea, I guess, that you know, you warp into a different dimension, and you know, the distance between the two points that you're traveling is closer in a higher dimension than it is in your regular four-dimensional space-time. But of course, that doesn't quite make sense with one of the things that Han says when he talks about, oh, you've got to make the jump to light speed. If you don't do the calculations just right, you can fly right through a star, bounce too close to a supernova, and that would end your trip real quick, wouldn't it?
Damn.
Well, if you were popping into another dimension and then popping back into our dimension, you wouldn't have to worry about crashing into stars in our dimension. So the whole thing's a little bit, it's not entirely clear.
Right, but give it up, you know what though, Stephen? Give it up to Harrison Ford for like summing up everything about light speed or hyperspace that we need to know in one sentence. That's it. That's all you need to know. Yep. It's very dangerous. It's very precise. It's very fast. That's it.
It is, yeah. One of the things that I can definitely say about it, however you slice it, is the idea of manual control of going to hyperspace and coming out of hyperspace, like pulling a lever, a human being pulling on the lever at the precise moment where you're at the planetary system where you need to be, is kind of silly, right? If you're traveling at hyperspace speeds at many, 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 many times the speed of light, you're not going to be able to time, you know, he hears the beep and he goes, all right, 3, 2, 1, go. And he pulls the lever back and they're at Alderaan. It's like, why would you have that be under manual control when you have a computer that's doing these things?
Well, maybe the ship pulls him out of hyperspace automatically and that switch is just him putting the light on.
It could be. I don't know. But he clearly, like, you know, over the course of the series, he has to push the lever forward to jump to hyperspace and pull it backward to get out of hyperspace. It gets especially ridiculous in the J.J. Abrams movies where you have people like coming out of hyperspace underneath a shield, but above the level of the planet.
All right, what else you have in your notes?
So the aerodynamics of the ships, most of these ships are ridiculously unaerodynamic, and so flight, especially the Millennium Falcon, is the worst offender in this. Flying through any planet with an atmosphere in the Millennium Falcon would be essentially impossible. It would just kind of, you know, unless you spun it like a Frisbee. Right? Have you ever tried to throw a Frisbee without spinning it?
Yeah, it goes like a foot, or it lands on a foot.
It goes like a foot, tumbles end over end, and then crashes into the ground. That's basically what happened in the Millennium Falcon.
But no, but then, all right, I'll play the devil's advocate. But it has thrusters beneath it and on the back on the back crescent there. So up and away, right?
Sure. Similar to that, you have X-Wings and other ships that bank while they're in space. Now, airplanes bank in the atmosphere because in order to make a turn, you have to actually align the direction that your lift is pushing with the direction that you want to make the turn in.
I want to say the word inertia has a bearing on it.
No, not necessarily, damn. Right? All because right. The way an airplane works is, you know, you move through the air, and as you move through the air, the wind, the way the air moves over the wings generates lift, which just pushes the airplane upward. Right, so if you want to turn an airplane, you can't just sort of turn it. You have to change your angle a little bit so that now the lift is still pointing perpendicular to the, you know, it's still pointing upward from the plane's point of view, but upward is now at a slight angle, and so you turn.
And right, and all of this, none of this design, X-Wing, TIE fighter, none of this matters once you're in space. You're talking about—
No, none of this matters at all when you're in space.
Okay.
But it looks cool, so, you know. Let's talk about the fact that the Death Star blows up Alderaan, which, number one, the speed with which that planet disintegrates is unimaginable, right? When you think about how large a planet is, the fact that it literally just sort of explodes instantaneously as opposed to crumbles in slow motion. Same thing with the Death Star explosion at the end of the movie.
Could one not say then that that is a statement on the power of the weapon?
I mean, it could be. It's a massive amount of power.
No, you're right, though. You know, it makes sense that it could, you know, I buy that it could destroy a planet or throw a laser through it and destroy it. But yeah, to obliterate it as if it was—
just explode it like an egg in a microwave. Yeah.
Right. And it all has to do with scale. It's kind of like how your eye can kind of tell when you see scaled water. You know what a wave in the ocean versus a wave in the bathtub looks like. Your eye just knows it.
You know the difference between an explosion in a model that's 3 inches wide and a planet.
And something that would be the size of a planet, right.
Right. But by the same token, right, even if you posit that that is true and that it has so much power that it can explode that planet that fast, you now have gigantic chunks of planet at unimaginable speeds, heading directly towards the Death Star that just blew up the planet. Like, it would just shred the Death Star into a million pieces.
Right. The explosion implies debris. They didn't disintegrate the planet and make it vanish like Doctor Who does.
Right.
It literally exploded.
Right. And that debris, because it's in space and there's now gravity affecting it essentially, would travel in a straight line until it hit something, in this case, the Death Star. So it would be a suicide mission, basically, every time the Death Star tried to blow up a planet.
And just to confirm my theory, if that were to happen, the velocity of the debris, untouched, would never lessen?
No.
Okay, that's what I assumed. It's hard to put that stuff, if you're not an astrophysicist, it's hard to put that stuff around in your mind, that it would never slow down.
No. I mean, the planet still, even though it is in pieces, still technically has some gravity to it, but those pieces are moving so fast away from the center of gravity that, yeah, those pieces are not going to slow down. They're just going to keep going until they hit something or, you know.
Or an atmosphere. Slow down from something's atmosphere or gravitational pull.
Well, what would have probably happened, Alderaan is presumably around a star, right? It has a sun. It's a planet going around a star. It would essentially form a ring around the star. All that debris would, you know, it would be like Saturn. I mean, that's what Saturn's rings are, more or less, is a satellite that got destroyed at some point or never properly formed.
And by satellite, he means a floating body, not a man-made satellite.
No, yes. Satellite, and to an astronomer, a satellite is anything that goes around anything else.
Right, and to 90% of the world, a satellite is like a satellite dish.
Well, that's a man-made satellite.
No offense to our listeners, because if I hear satellite, that's what I think.
Yeah, and then I guess my last two things, one of them is somewhat science-y, technical at least, which is the weirdness that a civilization that is advanced technologically as this civilization obviously is, would need to use physical media to transmit information from one place to another.
Yeah, it's a good point, because even nowadays you could be like, oh, Ben just got my email. Good, we're saved.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watched this movie streaming over the internet.
Right. So. No, yeah, it does. If you were writing Star Wars now with the knowledge of, you know, digital technology, you'd be like, all right, it's a physical item, all right? R2 has to get this key. It's a physical key, all right, there. It can't be something cool and digital. It has to be a physical item. All right, let me throw these at you real quick. Based just on the first film, what does Darth Vader's suit do?
Based just on the first film? It's a scuba suit. It's basically, it's for scuba diving, but he likes it the way it looks, so he wears it out.
All right, and I know you have one more science, but I'll throw this at you. What would moisture farming entail?
Well, so that makes some sense, right? They're on a desert planet. There's not a whole lot of moisture. And so they're evaporators. He calls them evaporators. They're essentially the opposite of evaporators, I guess. There is some moisture in the air. And in order for them to be able to grow things or for them to be able to drink water or blue milk or whatever, they have to – there's no rivers. There's no – you know, we never see any rivers or lakes or anything like that on Tatooine. So the only moisture that they have available to them is the little bit of moisture that's in the air, and they take that moisture and they condense it out of the atmosphere into a form that is then usable as liquid water. That's what I always assumed. I don't know if that's canon either, but
I always thought it was just a cool idea because, like, they live in the desert. I as a kid, I thought they were digging. I thought those machines were digging into the ground for water. But it's just a cool idea.
So, and then my last science thing, which I think is kind of cool. And I had to look some of this stuff up and found some cool stuff that I had not realized before, is the idea of the binary sunset.
Ah, go. Yes. Good call. Yeah.
So in order for a binary sunset to happen, right, you have to have a binary star system, and you have to have a planet going around that star system. Now, we know of a lot of planetary systems where the stars are in a binary, and then there's a planet going around one or the other of those two stars, right? What we have less of, but a surprisingly large number that I did not realize until I went and looked this up earlier today, there is a surprisingly large number of actual planets where the two stars go around each other and then the planet orbits around in a much bigger orbit around both of the stars simultaneously, which is called a circumbinary planet. And we know of, you know, a couple dozen of these things in our own galaxy. And I think it's kind of a cool idea. The reason why that's different than a star going around one star of a binary is because we you know, or at least we get the sense that Tatooine has night and day. And so in order for it to have night and day, both of the stars have to be on the same side of the planet pretty much at all times.
Right, for there to be a dark side of the planet at one point.
Right, otherwise, you know, there would be times where one star was on one side of the planet, the other star was on the other side.
You'd have a light bulb on both sides of the planet 24/7.
Exactly, right, and so you would have no day. And that, again, there are planets like that that actually exist.
I think Las Vegas is one of those planets.
Or New York, which is why it never sleeps. What would happen, depending on how, you know, what the relative distances are between those the binary orbit and the planet's orbit around them, is that as the two stars orbited around one another, you know, they would move a little bit further away and a little bit closer to the planet. And so they would change relative sizes. And there would be times where one would be in front of the other. They would essentially, you know, they could eclipse, like one of them would eclipse the other one once, you know, every whatever their orbital period is. And so I think it's kind of cool that you could have, like, you know, these solar eclipses that were literally solar eclipses where these two suns were eclipsing one another.
Interesting. Let's just wrap up by saying Star Wars 1977, divorced from every type of baggage you could possibly imagine, I still just love it as a two-hour sci-fi adventure. I think it's just part of my childhood, yes, and I have such nostalgia and love for it. But even just as a grumpy old man revisiting it, like, damn, there's a lot of fun stuff in this movie.
Yep. So your grades?
A+ for entertainment value and B for science.
Ooh, that's okay.
Haven't you gotten the joke by now? The last 6 episodes, I've given everything a B for science because I'm a pushover of a teacher and I'm not smart enough. I'm not, you're the expert.
Yeah.
You can judge if you like the movie, but I can't judge if science is accurate.
Based on everything you know and this conversation, surely you know that it's not a B.
No, I would honestly say NA because it's not even trying to advance any scientific theories.
For me, Star Wars is, again, it's a movie that I literally do not remember a time of not having seen. I think I know that it is, without any close competitors, the movie that I have seen more than any other movie ever.
Yeah. It is just something about rewatchability, man, because even back then, in the 80s, we had tons of stuff to watch. We didn't have to watch Star Wars for the 5th time. And we did.
Well, so there are a lot of movies like that for me as a kid where there's a whole bunch of stuff that we taped off HBO or that we bought that we watched over and over and over again as kids that I don't watch very regularly at all as an adult. Star Wars is one of those movies that, you know, if I'm sick and I'm laid out on the couch, I probably watch the whole original trilogy once or twice a year, I think, still, even now as an adult. And I've seen this movie like literally hundreds of times. Easily.
I know you're giving it an A+, Stephen. What do you give it for science?
I mean, it's it's obviously an A+.
Okay.
It is an F for science.
Okay, done.
Although there is, you know, I think it's, you're right. You could make an argument. As I was writing this down, I was thinking, okay, well, is it fair to even give it a grade in science? But
it's not.
That's our mission. That is our mandate here on this show.
And no, so, you're right, because on one hand, you can't say, we have stated in our opinions, it is most definitely science fiction. Therefore, it's only fair to give it that grade, to give it a grade.
I mean, it's terrible on science, but, and I will say this about the movie as a way to transition into the next one, it gets a pass on a lot of this stuff, and we've talked about this before, because it takes place in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge part. Like I've said that one of the principles for me of science fiction and believability is the closer it is to in time and or space to our actual world, the harder I am, unconsciously most of the time, on whether or not the science matches up.
Right. The more fantastic it is, the easier you can be, because you could tell, like, Blade Runner is obviously meant to be sci-fi in a used real world. Right. Star Wars is science fiction that's in a fantasy world that never existed and is not trying to be real.
Right.
And I think by dint of that, Flash Gordon is similar.
Well, no, that's my whole point, right? Because Flash Gordon is, yes, you are correct. It is not necessarily trying. It is not trying to be real. But because it does take place in our world with actual human beings from Earth.
Yep. Heading out into space, you're right.
Play football for my favorite NFL team.
How about this? How different Star Wars would be if it was exactly the same, except Luke Skywalker was an Earthling who willingly went up into outer space.
I think it would be, honestly, I think it would be bad. Yeah. I don't think it would be nearly as good of a movie.
It'd be definitely different. I don't
know. And that's part of what I think Flash Gordon gets wrong right off the bat. for me.
Oh, okay. We're going to get into this. 1980s Flash Gordon, directed by Mike Hodges, produced by Dino De Laurentiis with a wonderful score by Queen. It is a crazily colorful, willfully silly, very energetic, action-y, fun science fiction movie.
Cheesy.
It is cheesy, but
you have to use the word cheesy.
I don't, though.
Like it or don't like it, it's cheesy.
I think it was Susan Sontag. Camp is failed seriousness. When something is described as campy, she, who is a critic, a cultural critic, she believed that camp is when you tried to be serious and failed. And I don't think that Flash Gordon ever tries to be serious.
Oh, but I didn't say campy. I said cheesy.
Cheesy implies camp. Like, you're unintentional.
I know. I think campy is different from cheesy. I think that's the whole point.
Okay. Define. I'm going to get defensive. Don't let me. Define cheesy as you mean it here.
Like or pertaining to Flash Gordon, the 1980 film.
So you can't define the cheesiness.
I mean, come on. All right. Everything.
Is it Go Flash Go? Is it Flash I Love You, but we only have 14 hours to save the Earth?
How about the fact that Flash Gordon is wearing a shirt with his own name on it? With the logo of the movie on it.
Yep. And I'm not going to ever make these excuses, but, you know, that's part of the character. That's how he looks.
I get it.
He's a famous football player. Why would he be? It is weird that he'd be wearing his own
name. He's wearing a shirt with his own name on it.
It is weird. I'll give you that.
But it doesn't look like a if you were wearing like a football jersey that had his name on the back, like that I could get. But it just says Flash on it, as if like in this world.
This is already what we're opening with a movie where an evil emperor from another galaxy pours hot hail all over the planet. And we're worried about, why would this guy wear his t-shirt with his name on it?
I'm talking about that not as a in-world sort of thing. I'm talking about that purely as an aesthetic choice that the filmmakers made. Clearly, that was a deliberate choice.
Maybe it's meant to show that he's egotistical and a little dim.
Is it, though? It doesn't feel like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't feel like he's wearing a Flash Gordon the football player shirt. It feels like he's wearing a Flash Gordon the space adventurer shirt.
Flash Gordon and Dale Arden are kidnapped and are rocketed into outer space by the manic Hans Zarkov, who suspects that there is a threat against the Earth, and it turns out that the loopy guy is right. And it kind of bugs me that his assistant gets run over by an airplane and he doesn't even care. Always bugged me. Just a weird.
Not even close to the darkest moment in this movie.
Okay. I don't even know where to begin. I'm not going to compare it to Star Wars because it's space apples versus galaxy oranges, but I freaking love this movie. Yes, it is arch. That is the word that I will use. It is broad. It is not yuck yuck funny, but it is cocked eyebrow funny. And I do believe it. Mike Hodges directed Get Carter. This is not a guy who is necessarily overly obsessed with production and set design. That was for this movie. And it works. It's gorgeous, man. All those costumes and that curtain hanging down. It is a beautiful-looking movie, and even though it's
so cheesy.
Cheesy doesn't mean anything to
me. Every one of those costumes is cheesy. Like
That they are very different cultures from a weird, distant galaxy.
Yeah,
that's
but they're
all.
Obviously meant to look like the comic book versions of these things, not the actual versions of these things.
Because they don't want to have a giant throne room scene where everyone looks human except for like, oh, there's one alien over there and there's a guy with wings.
Yeah, but
they wanted to populate it by wild, eclectic.
But do you see what I'm saying? Like my point is that all of these things feel like they are referencing the comic book. Or like they are trying to be the comic. Again, this is not a dig. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't appreciate it for that reason. But it feels like, hey, look, remember this thing, And this I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second here because this is
that's
what
a fair
I was
point.
About
before you climb on your soapbox, let me just interject real quick. Except for the name of the characters, I never read a Flash Gordon strip, comic, book, nothing. I walked into Flash Gordon as a kid like, oh, it's a space movie based on an old character. That's literally – so if half those characters in the throne room are meant to reference certain plot threads or characters, I don't know. I just know that whole bit, even though, yes, the whole football thing is very silly. But again, not accidentally silly. I think it's silly on purpose.
Again, yes, it may very well be true. That doesn't, to me, make it any more enjoyable. Now, I think part of the thing is that you saw this when you were a kid, and I saw bits and pieces of it when I was a kid, but it was not a movie that I watched at all. I don't think I ever saw the entire thing all the way through until this week. I saw bits and pieces on television. I know my brother talked about it. My older brother liked the movie a lot. It just wasn't a thing that I watched as a kid. And I think it's, like we talked about last week, it's one of those movies where you have to see it as a kid in order to appreciate it. If you watch it for the first time as an adult, it's just, you can't, you know.
I don't know. I think that would be a better statement. For some reason, you have this disconnect with childish things that you don't, or childlike things. And as an adult, you kind of have this kind of, nope, doesn't really get through my filter because I'm adult, Steven.
I don't think that that's necessarily true. I fully believe.
And I'm not knocking you. I'm just my own dime store analysis.
Well, I fully believe that if I, you know, if you knocked me on the head and I didn't have any memory of Star Wars and I watched that movie, I do think the effects hold up. I do think the characters hold up. I do think, you know, everything about that movie still works in 2020.
Same with Flash Gordon.
This is where I'm getting at here.
I think some of the special effects are a bit dated, yes, but for the most part,
special effects are terrible. They're terrible, especially after watching Star Wars the day before.
I do not agree. Rudimentary, maybe. But like that stuff with the Hawkmen flying, yeah, you can see those composites if you want. But
it's terrible. Like, especially after what, look, when you consider the fact that, like, and I think you're right. I think a lot of it is deliberately terrible. I think all of those things are meant to evoke the terrible 1940s film serial versions of those things. As opposed to Lucas, and now I'm going to get up my soapbox, and don't interrupt me for a second, please, because, you know, it's high up here, and if I fall off, I could hurt myself.
Go, box it.
The difference between these two movies to me, Lucas said, I want to recapture the spirit of the joy that I felt going to Flash Gordon serials. He did it again, obviously, with Indiana Jones a couple years later and his, you know, the adventure serials of his youth. He said, I want to take these things from my youth, I want to give modern audiences an experience of what it was like for me that they can't experience because they can't go back and watch those things the same way that I did because technology has progressed, because storytelling has progressed, because we have, you know, it's a different world now than it was in my more innocent days. And so I want to create something that will give people that sense of wonder, that sense of awestruckness at these amazing effects, at the storytelling, at the adventure and grand and big, bold themes and mythical stories and all that kind of stuff. And he decided, you know, I want to package that. I want to take those things and I want to do them in a way that's entirely my own, that evokes those things, but doesn't just merely copy those things. And I think that Flash Gordon, and I think, again, it's 100% intentional. I think Flash Gordon is much more of a, we want to take these old serials and we want to just sort of do a version of them now. We're not going to really update them. We're not going to really do anything with them that is better or different than that old thing. We just kind of want to feed on the nostalgia of those things. And I think that this is true of a lot of the current wave of nostalgia projects have for the 80s, where it's like, oh, hey, look, the person's wearing a jeans jacket. Oh, hey, look, remember this thing that happened in the 80s, or, you know, things like Stranger Things or Turbo Kid, or, you know, any number of things that have come out in the last 5 or 10 years that are very deliberately like, I want to ape the aesthetic of the 80s. My goal is not to recreate that feeling that you had in the 80s as much as it is to sort of go, oh, hey, look, remember that thing? And to me, that's all the difference in the world between a George Lucas and a Steven Spielberg and a Flash Gordon or a Stranger Things. And so
I love the soapbox. I don't disagree. I do want to argue with you one point, though. Did you not just explain the difference between an homage, which is what Star Wars is, an homage to 5 or 6 different things, and an adaptation? Which is what Flash Gordon is. It's an adaptation of an existing work. And, you know, their choice was either, all right, do we want to, you know, make Flash Gordon more modernish looking like Star Wars? Or do we want to, I mean, they start it in the modern world.
I think you can do an adaptation that doesn't have to ape the aesthetic of the original. I think there are plenty of, you know, for instance, a movie we've covered on this podcast, The Thing, didn't just try to be like, oh, hey, we should like shoot it in black and white and have campy acting style and one woman character. They didn't have any women characters, but my point being, you know, they didn't try to like, oh, let's make this feel like a 50s movie. They said, let's take that thing and make a thoroughly modern movie, modern for the 80s, about that same sort of thing.
I honestly, I get your point, and it's well argued. I just think that I think that Flash Gordon was made to be, it takes place in the modern day, but it's in a bizarre universe. And yeah, we're going to use the designs from the comic strip, partially because they're so cool, and partially because we don't want to, if we start from scratch, then we're inevitably going to rip off Star Wars with our designs.
Just, when I say cheesy, it just feels very amateurish to me. Like, the whole thing feels just very like high school play version of all of these things. The acting, like I said, the special effects. The only thing that I like is the effects that they did for the sky on these planets, where they clearly did some sort of practical photography of
stuff. So beautiful. Those matte shots are just wonderful.
That is a cool effect. But like all of the compositing of like the ship, I mean, again, especially after watching Star Wars, I feel like—
Those are good effects for 1980.
They were not.
Everything gets,
they were not
everything
because Star Wars came out in 1977, and the special effects blow this so far out of the water.
Not everything gets remastered 15 times, Steven. Flash Gordon exists on the print that was
matter.
Made on.
That's not my point. My point is the way that they're staged, the way that they look, the way that the ships move. It all looks like cheesy 1940s serial.
I love it. You don't love the design of that ship that looks like a giant bee?
They look like models on strings.
But they are models on strings. I mean, what are you going to say if you watch a Ray Harryhausen film? This was not made in 2008.
Scott. Think about the other movie that we're talking about. Nobody watches Star Wars and says, oh, those look like models on strings.
Steven, you just said the original theatrical cut of Star Wars has those blocky composite shots. There's nothing in Flash Gordon that's as ugly as those old blocky composites around the TIE fighters.
I disagree. I think that they are conceived in an ugly way. Like,
what's ugly? The tree planet where the guy has to stick his hand in the tree for the...
The editing is clunky. The way the ships move is, I mean, like, if you don't see it, man. But like, again, I think all of it is deliberate. I think that that shouldn't hurt your enjoyment of the movie because I think all
it
of
doesn't.
That
doesn't. I think that they were like, as far as like the movement of the spaceship as it pulls up at the temple after Flash and Baron fight on the thing, the ship pulls up like it's a limo and then takes off because that's the technology they had.
No, because those effects are worse than like the original Star Trek series. I think that this movie is exactly what Lucas was running into, why it took him so long to get Star Wars made and why he ran into so many closed doors is because they were expecting this sort of juvenile, cheesy, terrible special effects, campy, bad.
Flash Gordon is precisely as juvenile as the first Star Wars. There's a lot of whining in Star Wars. It is juvenile in a good way.
I mean, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
I will argue this for you all. One interesting note, I'll give you this. Sam Jones, who played Flash Gordon, did not have a good time on the set. Allegedly, there was big arguments between him and the producer, and he bailed at the end, and he wasn't there for ADR, so they dubbed over his entire performance.
So depending on who you ask, they dubbed over somewhere between 50% and all of it, depending on—
All of it. I've seen the movie 10 times. His voice is uniform throughout.
Again, according to Sam Jones himself.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, he was also the guy who left the set disgruntled, so maybe he has his own version. Okay, can we talk about more things I love? I love Princess. I love Kala, the evil woman. I love Clytus. I love that Clytus and Kala seem to have a thing going on. I love the creepy-ass machine that sucks the memories out of Hans Zarkov. Yeah. I love the giant stump that they have to put their arm in for a rite of passage.
Which
I love... You're diving straight into Phrygia, and then you see like a giant ice planet zooming into the frame.
Can we talk about a couple of those things real quick, though?
Yeah.
So for as cheesy and as juvenile as this movie is, and you cannot deny that it's juvenile, and again, that's not an epithet, that's just a fact. It is aimed squarely at children.
I'll think of a better word than juvenile, but yeah, okay. I don't entirely disagree.
It is also dark as F.
Well, Flash does die in a gas chamber. That freaked me out, and I remember my grandmother did not appreciate that.
Okay, right. So first you right, right. So let's talk about some of the things that happen here. They strap Flash Gordon down into a chamber and execute him by gas. And they draw it out too. It's not a matter of like, oh, well, this is a thing. Like, they treat it with like for as silly as the rest of the movie is, they treat this one scene with so much seriousness that it's like, wow, they're literally like treating this as if we're watching the execution of an actual person. He dies. He comes back alive. So we have a kid who gets killed by his own father when he fails the manhood test by sticking his arm in the tree, and he gets stung by the thing. And it's implied that he's going to go crazy. And so the dad's like, all right, well, you know, better that I just stab you with my sword than that you go crazy.
And we don't have and we don't have cultures in America that do dark, dark things like that?
I'm not saying that they don't exist, obviously. I'm just saying it's supposed to be a kid's movie. We have a battle to the death on this spiked platform, which, you know, they fall on and bleed. And
nobody dies. It's not a battle to the death.
It is a battle to the death. The fact that they don't – he saves him at the end is, you know, important. But the battle is – set up as a battle to the death.
If nobody dies in a battle, how could you call it a battle to the death?
It was a battle. It's because that was ostensible the rules of the thing. They broke the rule. Right, an ostensible battle to the death. You have this woman being whipped and then tortured by her own father.
Yeah, to show how evil they both are. That Ming the Merciless would not even stop torturing his own daughter. That's how evil he is.
And you have the robot dude, who we'll talk about him in a second.
Clitus is not a robot.
That's one of the things I want to talk about. But we can segue into that after I say this. He ends up on the spiked platform.
Can that be the tagline for this episode? Clitus is not a robot.
He ends up on the spiked platform, and he gets killed by one of the – he falls on the spikes, which is kind of brutal. And then they linger on his face with his eyeballs popping out of his face and, like, blood all over him. And I'm just like, man.
His eyes ooze out of his mask, and it is a great – moment, and here's why. Even a little kid could tell you this. Your evil bad guy has to have, even if it's quick, it has to be nasty. That's the lesson.
It was plenty nasty before they showed his eyeballs falling out of his head.
This is what happens to bad people. That's the lesson of a fairy tale.
They showed him get impaled on three spikes at the same time. That's not nasty enough. They have to show his eyeballs falling out of his head in pools of blood. Like,
this is the guy you were just complaining about. He was whipping Princess Aura 10 minutes earlier. And
so
now
let's talk about this now. What is he? Because I couldn't tell whether he was a robot or a guy in a terrible mask. Tell me, try and tell me that mask is not cheesy. I will. AF.
Flash Gordon historians can fill me in on the background of General Clitus, but he's clearly human because he melts.
Is it a mask?
His eyes kind of ooze out.
Is that supposed to be a mask?
Yeah,
because it looks like a kid's Halloween mask. With the bottom jaw that kind of sort of a little bit moves when he talks, but not really.
Well, again, you're getting into late 70s technology here. You want to see, you think that's bad. Wait till we get to Logan's Run.
Woo. Again, compare that to, say, Chewbacca, who had like a fully animatronic face.
Okay, Steven. All right, I'm about to extract this out of you, and it's going to feel good. You are a director, and in my opinion, a very good one. You know how to look at a frame. You know how to use light and color and depth of field. You know, I've seen you do it.
Well, I know how to hire Drew to do that for me, but yeah.
Yeah, true. You know how to hire good people. Smart. Good call. But you can't tell me that in a lot of these interiors, you're just like impressed by just the look, the production design.
No, I think it looks like a school play. Like,
oh my.
I don't know how else to say it.
All right. Fair enough. All right.
I think that's the aesthetic that they were going for. But it looks like they're trying to look cheap.
No.
If they weren't trying to look cheap, then you're right. It is camp.
I'm going to name three things about this movie that you will compliment. Ready? One, the score by Queen.
Yes and no.
Not just the key, da-na-na-na, flash, I mean, the cool little guitar licks and the actual orchestral music.
Well, the orchestral music they didn't write, but the...
all right, yeah, you're right. But there are, what's the word I'm looking for? There are cues and
oh yeah, they definitely have cues
and themes throughout that's theirs.
Queen is one of my favorite bands of all time. Almost everything that they contributed is a variation on that same theme. I don't think they did anything groundbreaking with it. If you want to talk about Queen soundtracks, I think the soundtrack to Highlander is infinitely better than this one, personally.
Yeah, and to be fair, I want to make sure we mention the other composer is one Howard Blake. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is some really cool this Queen and his music together. All right, the performance by Max von Sydow in 1980 to obviously Ming is meant to be a character of some form of, all right, he's from deep, deep outer space, and yet somehow he's of Earth Asian descent.
He represents the Yellow Menace.
Right. Know? But aside from the name, there's like, oh man, thank God he didn't do anything racist and ugly, because that would just put a black mark on this movie for me. And it's just, he just plays it like an Englishman, an angry Englishman.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he didn't go all Mickey Rooney on it. I mean, it is somewhat, I mean, it is not somewhat, it is absolutely, the character has its origins in racism.
Oh, definitely.
For sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Very true. And one thing that I guarantee you that we will agree that is awesome in this movie, and that is the bombastic, wonderful performance by Brian Blessed as the winged Prince Voltan.
The guy that looks like Scott Allen Perry?
Yes.
With a Scottish accent?
The guy who says, who wants to live forever? Oh, he's just that greatest sidekick character.
I wrote that line down because that line is also the title of a song from Queen's other soundtrack.
Yeah, Who Wants to Live Forever, yeah. Like, I mean, I love that he kind of like adventures his way into these disparate sidekicks. And that's like one of the great fun things. And it also obviously
well, it's very
is in
episodic.
Star Wars. It's very much like obviously the hero's journey that Star Wars took from as well, which is pick up a bunch of sidekicks and help along the way. And I think Flash Gordon does thanks mainly to Timothy Dalton and Brian Blessed by instilling those characters with some actual color. I really like it. I really like it.
Let's be honest. Okay. Sam Jones.
Not a good actor.
And the character of Flash Gordon, if you try to compare that to Luke Skywalker,
it's not even remotely. I don't mean this as a knock on Sam Jones, but it's maybe a combination of not a stellar actor and that dubbing.
Yeah.
But he is kind of like he's likable. He's not terrible, but he's wooden. He's kind of wooden. Yes, I'll give you that much.
Well, it's not that interesting of a character.
And Melody Anderson, who has done much better work, and she's adorable here. She has an early scene where she's cheerleading, and essentially that's what she mainly is. She's mainly a passive character. And Topol as Hans Zarkov, very wild-eyed and fun, you know, kind of the mad scientist.
I mean, they're all very over the top. Everything about this movie is over the top. The acting, the characters. I didn't even talk about, because you mentioned it, the guy getting his brain zapped and all of his memories erased. File that under dark as F.
There's dark stuff in Star Wars too, sir.
There's like a couple. Well, there's like one dark moment in the original Star Wars.
He comes home and his aunt and uncle are slaughtered.
Yes. And that's all right? A very dark
We
moment.
Watch an old man disintegrate in front of our eyes, a man we've grown to love. Come on, man.
Yeah, but that's a triumphant moment. That's played as much as a triumph as it is. He chooses that.
Yes, you're right. And Star Wars is posited more as melodrama, and Flash Gordon is posited as a comic book. So therefore, the tonal difference is legit. It's fine.
So anyway, whatever. That's not
science.
Yes. Let's talk about some science.
Steven, does hot hail actually exist?
I don't know.
Do you love the idea of a being from another planet just deciding for no reason to mess with us and just turn our weather systems against us?
Well, so there's a line in the movie that somebody says, I think that Ming says to Flash or to somebody, yeah, it must be to Flash or it might be to Dale, but he says, if you knew anything about the universe, you would have hidden from it in terror. Which is one of those things that actually has some scientific backing to it.
That line is great, and it sounds exactly like something that H.P. Lovecraft would write. If you had any inkling of the darkness out there, you would never hurl your bodies into the void.
Right, but he's talking about it in a very sort of literal sense. He's saying that.
No, I know, but it's a great line for that reason. It speaks to dark things, right. You know.
Well, but Earth people announcing their presence to the universe is one of those things that's controversial among scientists. It's a thing that we've tried to do, right? We're constantly looking for other extraterrestrial life in other places via, you know, SETI searches and whatnot. We at one point beamed a message out via a giant radio telescope to a place that, you know, we don't think it's going to get to anytime soon and probably doesn't have life anyway. It was more of an experiment. But there was a big debate, and there still remains a big debate, as to whether or not announcing ourselves as an intelligent civilization to the universe is a good idea.
Right, especially considering how rotten we are.
Well, yes and no, right? Because the history of humanity shows that a species like human beings, for a species to get to the point where human beings have gotten, requires a species that is kind of ruthless and
dominant, domineering.
And we talked about this, I think, a little bit when we talked about Arrival.
Yeah, right. That's a movie that exactly says it never turns out for the less advanced civilization.
Right. And if you believe that there are lots of civilizations, and if you believe that they like to spread the way humanity does, then them finding out that there's another species that is not currently a threat to them but may become a threat to them at some point in the future, then it seems logical that the first thing that they would do upon learning about that kind of species is destroy them so that they don't ever have to compete for galactic resources with this species that is now turning into a galactic species.
Yeah, no, it is a fair question. Where do you stand on the question of should we be sending messages out into space or should we just quietly stand in the background and hope we're not noticed?
I mean, who knows? So we don't have enough information about the universe. The point is that if life is plentiful...
No, but the question itself says a lot about the person who answers it, because it kind of implies if you're an innately pessimistic or optimistic person who would say, yes, an advanced species would see that we are better than the sum of our horrible parts. Or a pessimist would say, no, they'd look at us like ants and stomp us out.
Well, not just like ants. They'd look at us like a chimpanzee troop that was evolving into human beings. And we as human beings would probably stomp that out because we wouldn't want to share the planet with another species that was also intelligent and filled with avarice and, wanting to dominate everything and that we would have to compete. I mean, we do this, right? We've killed, we're going through a mass extinction right now. The fifth mass extinction in our planet's history is entirely caused by human beings because we've gone and we've destroyed everything. And a lot of that is, we go into an environment. Like I live in a place that used to be filled with feral hogs and mountain lions and, various other apex predators that don't exist here anymore because we've driven them all out either by killing them or by making the environment in uninhabitable for them.
All right, we're getting way off course.
So I don't know. I think that was what was the one moment of that whole movie there where I felt like, okay, well, that feels like a science point that in the movie's favor.
Okay, so the idea that a malevolent being from outer space would want to dissuade you from even communicating is an intelligent aspect of Flash Gordon.
I don't even think it requires them being malevolent, although in this case, obviously, Ming is. It could just be a self-interested species from outer space.
But that leads to the next question of how intelligent is a species that has a gun that shoots gloves?
Or how intelligent is a species that knows English despite the fact that they just discovered Earth like 20 minutes ago?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
has they never do. And has a marriage ceremony that includes with this ring I thee wed.
And here comes the bride.
Right.
A queen cover of Here Comes the Bride. The science, all right, there's lots of science. Stephen, how do you wipe someone's memory like it's a computer? Could you?
I mean, yes, in the sense that if you weren't worried about what other damage it did to them, you could absolutely. I mean, we've done that to people before. Talk about the crappy things human beings have done.
Oh, lobotomy.
We've lobotomized people, and it doesn't necessarily wipe out all of their memories.
But there are, neuroscience is aware of what part of the brain contains memory cells, correct?
Oh, no, we have no idea.
Oh, okay.
We don't understand at all the way memories work, from what I understand. I'm not a neuroscientist.
Oh, because whenever I hear a neurologist speak, they're like, well, this back part of the brain is your pleasure center.
And oh,
I'm
yeah.
How
we
do you
got
know
all
that?
That stuff. No, that stuff they know. That we have the brain mapped out pretty well. We just don't really understand how memories work at all. From what we can understand, memories are not at all stored the way that bits are stored in a computer.
Interesting.
Right. Your memories are extremely malleable. They're pliable. You can remember things that didn't happen. You can remember things the wrong way. You can conflate various memories together with one another.
All right. What about hot hail? Does hot hail exist?
No, because hail is ice.
Right. So if you're getting hot hail, I think that we would want to refer to Jess Phoenix because that means you're almost definitely somewhere in the proximity of a volcano.
Well, then it's not hail. Then it's lava bombs.
Or magma.
If it were hot hail. So you know what hot hail is? Yes, hot hail does exist. And you know what it's called? Rain.
Oh, because it melted.
If you heated up the hail, it would just be water.
Right. Hail is just little ice pellets. My God, this movie is so stupid. You're right. I now hate it. What can you tell me about the biology of a creature that exists only to sting people in the arm?
Is that the only thing reason it exists? I don't think that's the only reason. I think they
Or how about that awesome monster? He climbs out of the quicksand thing, and then he's on the ground, and this giant bulbous spider thing starts eating him. And then someone comes down and saves him by shooting the monster. It's one of my, I love whenever that happens in a movie where the hero would have literally died if someone didn't just come along at the right moment. He didn't do anything to save himself. He just, he was about to get eaten by this balloon spider thing and somebody saves him. It's just.
So here's another question for you, scientific question. Is it possible to fall in love with somebody that you just met like 10 minutes ago? Because at the beginning of this movie, Dale and Flash do not know each other. They go on this adventure that lasts maybe a couple of hours.
Well, I got, all right, yeah.
And then,
I got two answers.
Then she's like, oh, I want to marry you. It's like, they spent no time together. They did nothing that would imply that they should actually be in love anything for any reason other than they were in the comic book.
I got two answers. One, yes, I would fall in love with Melody Anderson after 6 hours. Yes.
But would you fall in love with Sam Jones?
No. No. But B, and this part is more important, it speaks to the exact romantic nature of the 30s comic strip that inspired the film.
Yeah.
In a real world, no, of course not. But in the world of this kind of comic book, the pulpy comic strip, yeah, the heroine would fall for the hero by the end of the story.
You're making my point for me. That's exactly what I'm saying, is that it's trying to just
That's part of what's so beautiful about the movie, is that it is so old-fashioned. It isn't a modernization of Flash Gordon. Well, my biggest science question for you, and I'm in the back of the classroom raising my hand, Dr. D, raise my hand, Dr. D. And you're like, you roll your eyes. Scott, what's your question? Well, okay, if these natural disasters are being caused by the moon getting closer to the Earth. Yes, yes. No, doctor, let me finish, doctor. Does that mean that the moon is getting physically closer to the Earth while the adventure is going on? And then at the end, when they save the Earth, does the moon just stay 12 miles from the Earth? Or does it slowly retract back to where it was, thereby decimating the oceans? Yeah. Explain this, Dr. DeGennaro.
Well, he cuts it down to, like, it's seconds. There's literally, like, a timer going. And it's like, oh, he's got, like, 30 seconds before the moon crashes into the Earth. And then you're right. I didn't think about this watching the movie. But he, like, stops the... Does he ever even really actually stop it? I can't, like...
Let's say that right now our moon is 10 miles away from the Earth. Guess what, Flash? We're all dead.
Yeah.
We don't need the collision. It's already done.
Well, but did I miss something? Because I feel like he goes and he kills Ming and Ming dies, but he doesn't ever like go
and...
stops
the countdown. Because the ring is...
What? But I thought Ring had like a machine he was pushing buttons on that made the
Without Ming, nothing works. It's like the head zombie. You kill him and everybody dies. And then the
is that
the
established townsfolk, at any point?
The townsfolk just... are like, yo, you saved your Earth. Yeah! He saved every one of us!
It's like, I killed the bad guy. We don't need to actually go turn the machine off. It's just as long as the bad guy.
And I love that they established this killer sentry robot, because you think it's going to zap him. And he goes, yeah, I love it. Gives me chills because he saved the Earth. But he didn't, because if he doesn't go home, like they decide they're going to stay logically, because what would happen? The three of them get on a ship, go back home, and they find Steven. You're the doctor of science. What would the planet look like if suddenly the moon was, let's say, 1,000 miles away.
All right. So in order for the moon to get closer to us, it would have to speed up. That's the first thing that has to happen. In fact, the moon actually is moving further away from us because tidal drag actually causes it to slow down. And as it slows down, it moves a little bit higher up in its orbit, aka further away from us. So in order for it to get closer to us without just falling onto the Earth, in order for it to maintain an orbit around the Earth, it would have to go faster. So if it were at, say, the height of the space shuttle, which is like 100 miles or so, space shuttle goes around the Earth once every 90 minutes, roughly, which means that the moon, if it were at the distance of the space shuttle, so if the surface of the moon were at the distance of the space shuttle, the moon obviously is a lot bigger than the space shuttle. So the center of the moon would be a little bit further away. But roughly speaking, you'd have the moon whipping around the Earth once every 90 minutes or so. And
that's enough. 90 minutes is just enough time to watch a Police Academy movie.
Which will be the last thing you ever watch because of the giant tidal wave.
Could you imagine if a Police Academy movie was the last movie you ever watched? Oh.
Tidal waves, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. It would be complete.
No, but all right, wait. Actually, I have Dr. DeGennaro. I have two questions. Would the moon being drawn closer to the Earth cause volcanic eruptions and hot hail and hurricanes?
This movie's confusing because I feel like he caused those by pushing the buttons.
Like no, were those are flashing.
At the very beginning, are they?
Those are indicators, not buttons.
No, I don't. It looks. I thought they were buttons. It's confusing.
I don't know. I'm making it up too. But no, he's definitely moving the moon closer to the Earth, and the implication is that that's what's causing the natural disasters.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't know when it got close enough. I guess maybe it could move tectonic plates.
Plus, if he had the power to do that, why wouldn't he just do it like a pool cue? Just bam. Why
would
he do it?
Well, that makes some sense because they say in that opening scene that he likes just playing with them. The guy asks him, do you want to just destroy it? And he says, no, I want to play with it first.
That's true. You got me. I like playing with things for a while.
Yeah. So that's the reason why he doesn't just straight up destroy the Earth. But no, I don't. It would certainly cause tidal waves. That much I can tell you for sure. I don't think we'd have to ask Jess. I don't think that it would be enough gravity to actually move tectonic plates to where you'd have earthquakes and volcanoes. But maybe, I don't know.
Can you even, you're a doctor of science, can you even comprehend the idea of two planets crashing into each other? I can't even, my brain, like, I can't even put it into my head.
Well, that's why we have a moon, is because at some point that happened and, you know, a big chunk of the Earth got blasted into space.
Some people have the scale, you know, astrophysicists are trained to have that scale in their head. I am not trained. I like, you know, it's like trying to consider a billion. I can't. I can see the relative nature of a billion, but I can't grasp it, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of a billion, we've about hit the billion second mark, so time to wrap this thing up, unless you got some more science questions.
This was a very fun episode. I just want to say that I love both movies. I'm not going to compare. Obviously, Star Wars is the better film, but man, I do not like people knocking Flash Gordon. I know Steven went at it fairly, and he didn't hate it. I have nothing but respect for his opinion. I do get a little bit irked when people look back on it and just call it crap, because it is campy and it is silly, but I think willfully so. Other people think that's to its detriment, and they have every right. That's the beauty of art, is we all see different things. But I adore it, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about these two movies.
So what's your grade?
Well, if Star Wars is an A+, Flash Gordon is an A. And for science, I'm going to say incomplete, or NA.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I just don't love this movie. I feel like maybe I would have if I'd have seen it when I was a kid.
No, you know what? I'm going to gill you. I would tell you that, because I am a film critic, and I am very much aware of nostalgia value, and I did an entire podcast about reality versus nostalgia. I will say that a good portion of this is legitimate love from my childhood. And my second part is, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, there isn't anything
wrong
with that.
I know. You're not saying there is. I know.
I will always love Superman 2, and was very disappointed when you and Drew tore it apart on your other podcast, because I watched that. That was probably the second most watched movie of my childhood after Star Wars. It's a hard movie to defend a lot of the choices in it, for sure. But, you know, I'll always have that love for it. This movie, I don't, because I think it's cheesy. I think it gets wrong everything that Star Wars gets right. And whether it's intentional or not, doesn't matter to me, because I just don't enjoy it. So I give it a D+. The plus is there just to soften the blow a little bit, because I knew you'd hate me if I gave it a straight D. It also gets an F on science, because, you know, who cares? I don't know. But yep, those two grades have nothing to do with one another. It gets a D+ because it's not entertaining to me, and an F because the science stinks. But, you know, I it's not a movie I'll revisit, but I will revisit Star Wars over and over and over and over again. And I'm glad we got a chance to talk about them.
Thank you all for listening. Coming up soon, we're going to be doing Jurassic Park versus Carnosaur with a paleontologist. It might not be the next episode, but it is coming soon.
Yeah. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.